Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Philip Gardner, co-chair of the African American Tobacco Control Leadership and Program Officer of the University of California Smoke and Tobacco-Free Fellowship Awards, and Dr. Alan Blum, founder and director of the University of Alabama Center for the Study of Tobacco and Society, about issues that disproportionately affect African American smokers, including marketing and menthol cigarettes. Really important topic that we've never really directly addressed. I'm really looking forward to these conversations.
I am too, and I'm also appreciating your expertise in the topic of tobacco prevention and control. So I'm glad to extend that as we focus on menthol and in African Americans as well. So this is going to be a great conversation, so stay tuned for that. But first, we do have some research that matters. And the first one is a really interesting study related to autism and something called fecal transplants.
This research offers hope in many respects, but we should say that this research is very preliminary. It needs much more extensive replication, but it's about fecal transplant. So isolating the beneficial aspects, the kind of the probiotic aspects of the feces that could actually promote your own normal gut reproducing to help get rid of the bad bacteria that sometimes seems to be associated with people who have autism.
And just for some additional background, there have been some previous studies showing that kids with autism didn't have several hundred of the species of normal bacteria in their gut or GI tract compared with people who don't have autism. So this link between the good bacteria in the gut has already been made. And there was also studies showing that some powerful antibiotics temporarily improved autism symptoms. So there are already sort of these links between trying to promote good bacteria in the gut as a part of trying to improve symptoms from autism and ultimately trying to understand more about why it happens.
And in this particular study, which was published in the journal Microbiome, they took 18 children who had autism spectrum disorder, and they were given them some antibiotics to essentially get rid of their normal gut bacteria. And then the children fasted for a half day, and then they underwent a bowel cleanse, which is why you don't do this at home. And then they were given this fecal transplant of healthy gut bacteria from very, very healthy screen donors. Again, some very controlled settings. And then laboratory analysis to make sure that they were getting this 99% healthy bacteria. And they took it for 2 days and then a lower dose for 8 weeks, stomach acid suppressant. And basically, then they were followed and see, you know, how did they do? Did their gastrointestinal symptoms that a lot of these kids have get better? And did other aspects of their autism, like some behavioral symptoms, get better?
And they found that 5 weeks into the study, the 18 children had experienced an average of 80% reduction in their GI symptoms that they had had ongoing prior to the study, and also that there was about a 25% reduction in their autism symptoms. It's unclear to me, Adam, looking through this, it doesn't look like there was a control group, so it's hard to know or how exactly they evaluated these symptoms. So it's always hard to know in these studies unless you have another group of people, you know, where you blind the study to know which children had it and which children didn't, and then follow them over time. That's usually a little clearer to then draw conclusions about the intervention than this particular study. So again, it is preliminary, but it's encouraging that we're getting new information and new possibilities.
Right. So more research on fecal transplants with children and others, adults with autism spectrum disorder, and maybe even probiotics, and see how these things work. Our next research that matters is something that we've recognized for a long time, which is sleep deprivation is not good, and we probably have some mechanisms why.
So this is a study about twins where they took blood samples from 11 pairs of identical twins who had different sleep patterns to look to see if the twin with shorter sleep duration had changes in their immune system. And in fact, they found that the twin that slept less had a more depressed immune system compared with his or her twin sibling.
This was published in the journal Sleep.
It reminds me of that study we covered in the past where they put college students in a hotel room and inoculated them with rhinovirus or the cold. And the kids in the room where they didn't let them sleep were way more likely to actually then develop symptoms.
Yeah, couldn't pay me for that study. This study, though, is interesting because the twins, presumably there is a genetic basis to some sleep disorders. And so here they can control for that because these were identical twins. But it really does show that the sleep duration under natural conditions actually is directly related to immune function. And the shorter the sleep is, the less the circulating white blood cells, the more likely people are to get that rhinovirus. Those college students who were stuck in that. Hopefully it was a hotel room and they had good movies.
I know. I hope so, too. All right. Sorry, we're mixing our studies. But the point is that sleep, and maybe there are genetic factors to it, but that longer duration of sleep is good for most people and maybe protective to your immune system.
Let's look at another research that matters, Christy. And this is about what is called fat shaming. So someone who is overweight and someone were to try to use the shaming to motivate them to lose weight. Like, you are really fat. You need to lose weight. I can't imagine someone saying that. I would never say that. But apparently, there's certainly a lot of stigmatizing bullying that occurs for people who are overweight.
That is true. Like, body shaming is pervasive, and it's a pervasive form of prejudice and bias. People experience this in cyberbullying and bullying at school and watching people critique celebrities' appearances and all kinds of public shaming. And when people are feeling ashamed because of their weight, they're more likely to avoid exercise, consume more calories to cope with stress. So this was really looking to see about the relationship between what they call internalization of weight bias and having a diagnosis of metabolic syndrome, which we know is linked to heart disease related to weight.
And in this particular study that was actually done at the University of Pennsylvania, they had 159 African-American women who were obese. And as you said, those who had this high internalization were three times more likely to actually develop what's called metabolic syndrome, and six times more likely to have abnormal fats like triglycerides compared to those who had this low internalization. So this shaming actually is really linked to the opposite of what you would like if it were actually effective, so it's not, which is increased weight gain, increased triglycerides.
I think it also highlights that this weight bias internalization, what that is, it happens when people apply those negative weight stereotypes to themselves, believing they're lazy or unattractive or devaluing themselves because of their weight. And so, I mean, I think this highlights, one, in that healthcare providers, the media, the general public needs to be aware that blaming and shaming patients with obesity matters and it's not effective to help people lose weight. But also, if you're a person who feels ashamed and who has some of that, those internal negative feelings related to your weight, that would be an important thing to share openly with your doctor so that you two can team up together to make a strategy to help get you healthier, both in your body and your weight, but also in how you feel about yourself.
Great point, Christy. Thank you. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Philip Gardner, co-chair of the African American Tobacco Control Leadership and Program Officer of the University of California Smoke and Tobacco-Free Fellowship Awards, and Dr. Alan Blum, founder and director of the University of Alabama Center for the Study of Tobacco and Society, about issues that disproportionately affect African-American smokers, including marketing and menthol cigarettes. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Our first conversation today is with Dr. Philip Gardner, co-chair of the African American Tobacco Control Leadership and Program Officer of the University of California Smoke and Tobacco-Free Fellowship Awards, about issues that disproportionately affect African American smokers, particularly menthol cigarettes.
Welcome, Dr. Gardner.
Well, look, thank you guys for having me.
Now, you are an advocate for issues related to the African-American community and tobacco use and cessation, and an expert in the field. Help us understand or give our listeners and us a picture of the rates of smoking in African-Americans versus other groups.
I think, actually, the latest CDC figures show that African-Americans that smoke are somewhere in the neighborhood of between 18 to 20%, about a little bit lower and sometimes a little bit higher than whites. I think what's unique, unfortunately, about African-American smokers is that they smoke fewer cigarettes per day and they die disproportionately from tobacco-related disease. And what I focused a lot of my attention on, that over 80% of African-American smokers smoke mentholated cigarettes. So I kind of have delved into the issue of what is menthol, what happened to bring this about, and what role does it play in tobacco addiction of African-Americans?
Well, I think we should just really dive right in with that. I think, you know, all listeners would certainly be aware of menthol in terms of cough drops. But when we think about cigarettes, menthol cigarettes are really disproportionately used by African-Americans. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's been the case for the last few decades. You might look at it this way. I would suggest to you that the actual predatory marketing of these products in the community, starting back in the 60s, even back during Jim Crow when African Americans couldn't go to certain stores or couldn't ride on buses, the tobacco company was hiring black actors and putting them on TV to promote cigarettes. They are hiring black executives in their offices. We have data that shows that advertising tripled in Ebony Magazine, one of the main black magazines during the 60s and 70s. In fact, Brown and Williamson spent 90, you know, I have this as an article I wrote some time ago, but 91% of their advertising budget went toward television as opposed to newspaper ads or radio spots, because they had focus group data that showed that African Americans looked at television a lot more than a number of their counterparts, but more importantly, they took away the messages from them. The tobacco industry went on to what I would say is usurp our idiom. You know, they got menthol's got a brand new bag, and the way James Brown would say it. There was the cool jazz festival, cool lexicon, and probably most hurtful of all, the tobacco industry. And even though there seems to be some motion away from this now, starting in the 60s and carrying on right up to the day, gives money to civic, religious, and political groups in the black community. And essentially, it's about a lot of silence. So can I even take it a step further?
Sure.
There's a number of cigarettes that have been specifically targeted to African Americans throughout the years. There's Uptown cigarettes in the late 1880s, early 90s. There's X brand cigarette, kind of playing on the Malcolm X thing, but starting in 2002, they came out with this thing called the Cool Mix campaign, and this was going to be a battle of scratching and DJs spinning raps and things like that throughout the country that was going to culminate in Chicago. This was blocked ultimately, but the upshot of it, one of the people who worked on that project, LaTanisha Wright, worked on the tobacco industry, was so disgusted, left the tobacco company and brought documents with her. And we come to find out that this has been a specific concern of the tobacco industry. They have things like focus communities and non-focus communities. Of course, the focus communities are inner city, black, and poor. And non-focus communities are upscale, suburban, rural, and white. Punchline is that menthol products are marketed more in the black community. We have data on this. Great study out of Stanford showing that as the enrollment of African Americans go up, the proportion, it's almost a dose-response relationship, the amount of advertising goes up correspondingly. That was in California. We also know this to be true in Boston, and we have other national data. The punchline being is that there are more menthol ads, there's more menthol promotions, and I guess to add insult to injury, I would even say that stronger, but we don't know each other that well, is that menthol cigarettes are cheaper in the black community than they are in other communities.
So this has been very targeted advertising. Is there also some perception or some hidden message in this advertising that implies that either menthols are safer or less toxic or they taste better, or are there other messages in there that are false in terms of safety?
But of course, I mean, that's the way that's what they're marketed for, that cool, refreshing taste. Unfortunately, that message has been accepted by smokers. I looked into this a bit. Focus groups done in the 60s, in the 80s, in the 90s, and even in the 2000s, in the aughts, among African-American smokers we know, think that menthol cigarettes are safer than regular cigarettes. and they're no more safer than anything else. I mean, menthol's a unique thing. We spent a long time trying to figure out, well, maybe it's the menthol that is disproportionately killing African Americans. I would suggest to you that it's a little broader than that. We have to have a broader definition of harm, and that essentially menthol helps the poison go down easier.
Hmm.
You might even look at it this way. All tobacco products that are sold, whether it's pipe tobacco, chewing tobacco, roll your own, Marlboros, whatever, all have menthol in them. It's just that the ones that have characterizing flavor just have more menthol in them. Let me give you some of the qualities of what goes on with menthol. Menthol activates cold receptors in your throat, in your lungs, gives the appearance of cooling sensation. That cooling sensation allows deeper inhalation. We know we have data that shows that folks that inhale menthol cigarettes inhale them deeper. We know that it activates taste buds. A great study that we funded here in the late 90s that the same taste buds that are activated by capsaicin, the active ingredient in hot sauce, are activated by menthol.
Dr. Gardner, let me ask you a question, because I know that the Food and Drug Administration banned all characterizing flavors in cigarettes other than tobacco and menthol. And I know that you are really one of the leaders nationally in trying to change that. It seems that the elimination of menthol in cigarettes would have a huge positive impact on the African-American community.
We even have data that shows, I'm trying to get to one of my slides where I have this data because I think that's the right question. Great study done in 2011. If menthol were banned, hundreds of thousands of lives would be saved. Look at it this way. If they've removed menthol from cigarettes and only 30% of the people, you know, decided to follow this, this data shows that over 500,000 lives would be saved. A quarter of a million would be African American. So the FDA knows this. I think this gets back to the heart of the problem. This was a law passed by the Congress of the United States and signed by the president and gave authority to the FDA to review the issue of menthol. It's written reports, two major reports, all agreeing that removing of menthol from the marketplace would improve the public's health. We've already done that. The problem is there isn't the political will at the highest levels of government to actually move on this. I mean, I think you go into a little bit more detail about that. Are you aware of the recent deeming regulations that the FDA put out in May of last year?
Yes, the regulation of not only the cigarettes, but also the cigars and cigarillos and electronic cigarettes. And I guess the one issue that would be a real important issue, would love to hear your thoughts on, are things like the cigarillos that are, again, disproportionately perhaps used by young African-American males.
Well, this is the whole point I'm leading up to. So part of the deeming regulations initially had 16 pages that documented pretty thoroughly that flavored little cigars and flavored cigarillos and the actual use of menthol in both the liquids for e-cigarettes and whether it's in hookahs or in whatever other products were problematic and would be restricted. That went to the Office on Management and Budget. The Office on Management and Budget redlined all 16 pages of that and sent it back to the FDA and say that you can proclamate this, but you can't say anything about these flavors and this menthol. We even know the guy's name who did it, okay? And I think, I don't know if you want to go into that level of detail, but you might look at it this way. The tobacco industry has great influence in the White House. Even when Obama was there, they'll have influence in the White House now. So a lot of, while we're still going to chastise the FDA and they should do this and they should do that, I think what's important is that at the local level, that people have the right to restrict, ban, and control flavors and essentially control the distribution and sale of these products.
Exactly to that point. For our listeners who hear this and think, gosh, that's wrong. It sounds like both there's been a targeting of advertising for tobacco products and for mentholated tobacco products to African Americans, and that there's evidence to say that if we cut out the menthol to be able to be in the products, that it would save lives, and yet we can't seem to get it done. What can our listeners do in advocacy to try to help shape policy?
That's the $64,000 question. These are the things we've been working on across the country in different cities. One is that local jurisdictions, whether cities and counties, can erect what we're calling buffer zones around schools that prohibit the sale of flavored tobacco products. This was done in Chicago. It was partially rolled back. There's a 600-foot buffer zone around Berkeley schools. So that's one way. There's a second thing that folks can do is that you can get local legislation to restrict the sale of flavored tobacco products to adult tobacco stores only. We're working in Minneapolis on this. They passed a flavors ban that actually did do that, that moved all the flavored products except menthol to tobacco-only shops. We are now working with folks there to try and get menthol added to that. And then there's a third way, and then this is would be the preferred way, but it's clearly going to be the fight, is that local jurisdictions have the right to ban the distribution and sale of menthol across the board. This was done in Santa Clara County in California, and it's being discussed a number of other places. So there are three options, and I think that's where we're at. Buffer zones can be built around schools, can sell it only in adult places, and then thirdly, can outright ban it, which I think we're going to attempt to do in a couple of cities.
Well, Dr. Gardner, we want to thank you for your leadership. It's clear that this is a long fight. It seems that the solution is obvious, but it's not easy. Thank you very much on behalf of your health listeners for being our guest today.
Thank you, Dr. Gardner.
We need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll share a recent conversation that guest co-host Dr. Elizabeth Parks and I had with Dr. Alan Blum, founder and director of the University of Alabama Center for the Study of Tobacco and Society, about tobacco and the African American community. We'll be right back with Your Health.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and our guest co-host, Dr. Elizabeth Parks. We're excited to be talking with Dr. Alan Blum, founder and director of the University of Alabama Center for the Study of Tobacco and Society, about his research, his experience, his vast wealth of knowledge about tobacco and the African-American community. Welcome, Dr. Blum.
Thank you so much.
I guess we'd just like to start out understanding a little bit more about you and how you founded the Center for the Study of Tobacco and Society. How did you become so committed to the study of the ways we interact with tobacco?
Well, full disclosure, Adam, you and I are related. We're first cousins. And we also have kindred interests and we're kindred spirits. So this is just such a treat and an honor to be on your program. I was really a medical student and expected to hear lots of talks and learn lots and lots about the major preventable causes of death and disease. And even well before going to med school, one knows that smoking, of course, is the leading preventable cause of death and disease. But I only received maybe half a lecture in 4 years on smoking. And the one that I recall was by Dr. Brigitte Namias. And in her talk on the devastating impact of smoking on the lungs, she showed slides of emphysema and lung cancer, and then she juxtaposed them with images of some of her patients literally dying of COPD or emphysema and lung cancer. And I was very struck by this, and I adapted her technique to develop my own programs. And when I got into residency, I noticed in Miami, at the University of Miami at Jackson Hospital, we were surrounded by one of the poorest neighborhoods in all of Florida. And I began taking out these slides and going to local schools, predominantly African-American, and showing them some of the ways that cigarettes were being promoted and alcohol was being promoted to them and their parents. And one thing led to another. We started a group called DOC, or Doctors Ought to Care. And we had a national program, and the DOC talks evolved into very specific efforts, such as aiming to counteract the targeting of African Americans by the tobacco industry.
Dr. Blum, I know you've started collecting advertising and advertisements and history of smoking in this country from multiple points of view. And I'm wondering if you could tell us about a particular item you have in that collection that really speaks to this targeting of African-American populations and how that's affected their rates of tobacco use.
Well, you know, it would be easy to show a slideshow of all the ads through the years. For instance, Ebony Magazine, the foremost magazine for African-American readers, has never, to the best of my knowledge, in its entire existence, it's now been sold from the longtime publisher Johnson Publications, but it never ran a single article on the devastating impact of smoking on the black community. As editor of the New York State Journal of Medicine in 1983, I published the very first article, to the best of my knowledge, summarizing the impact on African Americans by smoking. Up until that point, people were very fearful of even writing about this issue. And in a column in the Washington Post, I laid it out pretty seriously in 1986 that we were doing very little to counteract this. Not that the industry wasn't also targeting everyone, but the disproportionate impact of specific products such as menthol cigarettes on the black community really was beginning to be known, and very little was done about that. So if you were to ask me to pick out a single example, it would probably be the recording of Dr. Benjamin Hooks, who was the long-term director of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, at a conference of the NAACP in the late 1980s, early 1990s, in which he specifically addressed and responded to the critics by that time who were upset that the NAACP was still taking a huge amount of funding from Philip Morris Tobacco Company, makers of Marlboro. And he literally harangues the critics and suggests that anyone who would dare suggest that they return this money ought to go jump in a lake. He was very loyal to Philip Morris, and George Knox, who was then the vice president of Philip Morris, was one of the keynote speakers at that particular meeting. The tobacco companies have always had very important outreach to minority communities, and it's said that they were one of the earliest industries to employ African-American workers alongside all other workers and offering them equal opportunities. So there's been a divided loyalty to the industry. A lot of organizations, the Urban League, the United Negro College Fund, and many others have long been beholden to the tobacco industry.
Well, you know, we just had the opportunity to talk briefly with Dr. Philip Gardner, who I know you know well. And there are heroes out there, you, him, many others, that probably don't get the recognition. But I wonder, have we made progress? Are the issues that you wrote about and really highlighted, are those better now, or are we fighting different wars?
I think the problem today with some of the organizations that are working on this issue is that they haven't evolved. They haven't understood quite that the tobacco industry is very dynamic. Most people know today that smoking is dangerous to your health. They knew that 50 years ago when the Surgeon General's report came out. They knew that 30 years ago. I first wrote about it again in the late 1970s, early 1980s. I wasn't saying anything new. It's just that very few people had actually written about that. The government wasn't giving any grants to study smoking, least of all among minority populations, because the tobacco industry's power in Washington was so strong. Now, that power may not be quite as great today, but there's still a fear on the part of many people in academia, that's medical schools and universities, from attacking the tobacco industry. The campus that I'm on, the University of Alabama, will actually host Philip Morris in a few weeks at its career fair. They hire upwards of a dozen university graduates a year to go with a van at a salary that's probably as high as any that a college graduate can get today outside of the sciences, to go into the poorest and most socially deprived communities and make sure the Marlboros will be perfectly well situated as soon as they walk into the pharmacies or the convenience stores.
Wow.
I'm wondering if you have any other kind of interesting untold stories about your work in the tobacco industry and the anti-tobacco campaign.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I think it's there's so many really heartwarming moments. Eric Solberg, my long-term co-author, and I have done literally two-person protests. We call them house calls. We visited the Ebony Fashion Fair, which was long sponsored by R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. And they actually would tie in cigarettes such as Salem in with the fashion. That went on for many, many years. We've also gone to black rodeos. And we did go to a black nightclub for a Salem birthday bash at a nightclub in Houston called The Oasis. We were just trying to point out that, hey, this was really a cigarette promotion, and people really got it. They said, gee, we never thought about that before. So there's been mostly tragedy, however, because although African Americans have actually stopped smoking at a slightly greater rate, still the least educated and the poorest in our society are disproportionately affected by smoking.
Is the targeting of people of color worse or the better now internationally than it was 10 years ago?
That's an important question, Adam, because I assume that, as the industry has always done, and their profits, by the way, are at record levels, that the targeting goes on as well, if not more cleverly, than ever before, because they have been removed from certain medium. In the United States, there's no longer billboard advertising, but there's some creative internet advertising. Also, point of purchase has been limited. You can't go into stores and see too many ads today. However, that's part of the dynamism of the industry. My concern is the lack of dynamism, the lack of understanding on the part of health organizations, which are you know, counting the number of Marlboro signs on the head of a pin and thinking that that's really, you know, the way you compare minority neighborhoods with non-minority neighborhoods. That's just not what's going to hack it. Banning things isn't what's going to hack it. I think what's going to improve the situation is laughter and satire and ridicule, and using all of our funding not just to study this issue, but to purchase mass media space to get where the next generation is. Reach them on the internet, reach them on TV, reach them on radio, and podcasts like this one, so that people will be immunized against whatever this industry does. The picture isn't so simple. It's not what the CDC or the FDA says. It's a much more complicated issue than just simply saying that smoking's bad for your health.
Well, everything you've done, we really do appreciate it.
Thank you again, Adam. Fortunately, we're getting things online, as we have done for several years. Our website, which we're in the making of, is www.csts.ua.edu. And thank you for all of your work, not only North Carolina, but nationally and internationally, and in keeping the faith.
Well, we'll certainly put that website up on our blog and maybe get some audio. Maybe the audio you mentioned, if we can certainly
get
that up.
Yeah, it's quite stunning. And again, our whole point of the archive is irony, capturing Elston Howard and Hank Aaron in cigarette advertising in the 1950s and 60s is just sort of, and even Jackie Robinson for Chesterfield. These are things that people just simply don't believe when they see them.
Well, again, thank you so much. We're going to take a short break, but we've been talking with Dr. Alan Blum, founder and director of the University of Alabama Center for the Study of Tobacco and Society, about how tobacco affects the African-American community. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Elizabeth Parks. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Christy, if a listener wants to send us any comments or questions, they can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu.
Now we'd like to have our amazing executive producer, Laura Lacey, read us our very first House Call question of the day. Laura?
I'm a 43-year-old woman. In the past month, I've been experiencing increasing fatigue for no reason as far as I can tell. Do you have any advice?
We've got some thoughts. This is a really tough question, and it's a common issue. I mean, fatigue is one of those things that, boy, I mean, everyone experiences it at some point in time, and frequently every month, sometimes every week. But you're noticing it, something's different than it was in the past. And that's what I take seriously. This is different for you.
And also the fact that it's over the last month means it's not just a few days, but it's also not something that's been going on for a really long time. So that also is a clue to try to tease out. In terms of advice, I think one thing to know is if you Google fatigue or woman fatigue you're gonna get.
Don't do that.
Don't do that. Yeah. There are so many different things that can make you tired. It could be as simple as a virus or stress or not getting as much sleep at night to other things, like it could be a sign of depression or your thyroid being off or anemia or, I mean, just the list goes on and on. And so I would advise you to start keeping track of anything you can think of that makes you more or less tired, how much sleep you're getting at night. Try to keep track of some of those things and then go and speak with your primary care doctor to try to start teasing out, okay, this has been going on. How heavy are your periods? If you're having periods and menstruation, that can make you be anemic and make you tired. There are lots of different things that you can kind of work through in partnership with your doctor to tease it out.
Yeah, some people have been pretty fatigued with all the political things that are happening. I shouldn't go there, should I?
No. We're going to carry on. We're going to carry on. We're here to giggle and be happy.
Well, and the nice thing is, though, is the questions to ask and the reason we want you to bring the symptoms is this: the more in the history that we get, the more likely we're able to figure out which of the tests that we can do, because we don't want to run, you know, 1,000 tests. People are worried about cancer. Let's just have it out there. People worried about lymphoma. Those are unlikely to be the cause of your fatigue. But again, let's find out what you have and we can figure out what you don't have and get you better.
Okay, let's take our next house call question. Laura?
Recently, I've been getting more varicose veins. What are they and how can I treat the ones I have as well as prevent new ones from popping up?
You know, this is a question I get, surprisingly to me, more often than I would have expected. I don't think I got a single lecture in medical school, Christy, about varicose veins.
Oh, I got a lot of lectures from my mom about varicose veins. That's how I have my expertise.
Did she ask you what to do about them, or did she tell you you're going to get them? Just
don't worry about it. All of the above. Carry on. Sorry to interrupt.
Mom knows best. And I will say I have heard it more often from women than men who I get asked about the varicose veins. And basically, these are dilated veins predominantly in the lower legs that come about because the valves that typically move blood back, the veins move blood back to the heart, don't work as well sometimes, particularly in legs that get bigger over time, sometimes associated with weight. Sometimes fluid and those veins just can't keep pumping it up and they lose their ability. It's like a hose that kind of balloons out a little bit and the veins kind of stay there a little bit bigger.
And some people don't like them because they feel they're unattractive. Some people really have aching and sort of pain associated with them. The first step is often in wearing compression stockings or support hose or something to sort of keep a little support on your legs. And then there are a whole variety of treatments now for varicose veins that are exciting, that it's not quite as gruesome as what you might hear your grandmother or your mother tell stories of from the past.
But can be really expensive.
Oh, yeah.
The treatment could be is usually going to be a vascular surgeon or a dermatologist who might do, you know, some procedures. Most times you may not actually decide to treat them.
That's right. And in many cases, these are not dangerous to your life. And people worry a lot of times about blood clots and that sort of thing with varicose veins. But this is a different system of your veins and the way they work. So usually if you get swollen or something that happens with your varicose veins, it usually can be irritating, annoying, or may need to be treated. But it's usually not dangerous in the blood clot sort of way.
That'll conclude the house calls for today. And we want to thank you for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you and your health. Share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guests today, Dr. Philip Gardner and Dr. Alan Blum. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.